8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
We're exploring a fascinating world over the next few minutes, the world of artificial insemination. It's one of those terms that we encounter on a fairly regular basis, but often encounter and maybe sort of breeze past without ever really understanding kind of the details of how it is done, of the history of that technology, where it came from. And we especially don't stop to think about the ramifications, especially on a personal level. And certainly that was very much the experience of my morning show guest today, a gentleman by the name of Peter Bonney. And he is the author of a book called Uprooted: Family Trauma, Unknown Origins, and the Secretive History of Artificial Insemination. Peter Bonney was 49 years old when he first learned that his birth was the result of artificial insemination. He had never been told that. And because of kind of a special and complicated family situation involving the man he'd always thought of as his father, his father in every respect except the biological, this was a huge revelation for Peter Bonney, even larger than it would otherwise have been. And eventually Peter Bonney set out on a long voyage of exploration to try to track down his biological father, whoever that man was, who had donated sperm decades earlier. And that journey is fascinating in and of itself. But Peter Bonney also embarked on a long journey of discovery to try to understand the history of artificial insemination. And all of that is tied together and explored in this truly fascinating book. Again, it's titled Uprooted: Family Trauma, Unknown Origins, and the Secretive History of Artificial Insemination, published by Greenleaf. Peter Bonney, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. Happy to be here.
I want to make sure our listeners know the spelling of your last name, which is B-O-N-I. What kind of a name is that, may I ask?
I used to think it was Northern Italian. It still is.
Very good. Very good. So we could start our conversation in a lot of different places, but I think it makes probably the most sense for us to begin with that dramatic moment in your life when you discovered this fact about yourself, that you were the product of artificial insemination. Maybe ahead of the circumstances under which you learned this information, tell us where you were in your life at that time. You were 49 years old. Tell us more about where you were at the time, both professionally and also personally, in terms of your own family.
Right, sure. Well, you know, three factors I always looked at to have impacted the evolution of my frame of reference. I had a somewhat disruptive childhood, a working-class family. My dad was sick. Life was rather unstable. I was in 11 different schools in several states between the first and the eighth grade. I started and finished high school in the same spot. I had a state college education, the first one in my family. It opened many doors of opportunity. And then I had on-the-ground service as a special operations team leader in Vietnam, and that somewhat shaped my leadership style. But I always took my DNA for granted. In 1995, I was a business leader. I was a high-tech CEO specializing in companies that were facing difficulty. So I was in a project getting a company out of hot water when my 75-year-old stroke-recovering mother spilled the beans that Dad wasn't biological. He was sterile. And I was conceived with an anonymous sperm donor in the waning days of World War II with the help of Harvard Med School and a fertility clinic affiliated with Harvard Medical School. So for me, I was the same person. Nothing changed, but everything changed. My dad suffered from bouts of depression. He was hospitalized. He ended up taking his own life when I was 16. And the family kept that very quiet and perceived it as a flaw. Don't let anyone know about that. And that somewhat spilled over on me as well. Was I flawed? Was I carrying a flawed gene? And, you know, I always felt a little different in my family. I was fair-complected, had my dad's Northern Italian blue eyes, but blondish hair. As I progressed, my academic and life's achievements somewhat intimidated my family, actually on both sides. So learning this was just a confusing period with many conflicting emotions. I mean, Greg, how can you feel happy and sad and empty and fulfilled and deceived and relieved all at the same time?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just incredible to think of all that you experienced. And in fact, in describing what you kind of felt in the aftermath of this, one of the things you said, it was a little bit like the aftermath of a hurricane, which is wonderfully peaceful. And we'll get to that in just a moment, how from this sort of tangled web of all kinds of conflicting emotions, you also felt an extraordinary sense of peace and relief. Let's talk a little more about this moment when your mother revealed this for the very first time. I think it's interesting to note and for our listeners to know that she didn't first reveal this to you. Explain exactly to whom and under what circumstances she first revealed this about herself and about you.
Well, she had a post-operative stroke, and she was in rehab, and she lost a little bit of her memory. And as visitors were coming to the rehab center to see her, she began recounting the story. I'm sure it helped her just recapture her memory as well. And friends said, "My gosh, Chick, you need to tell your son this." She said, "Oh, I can't tell him. He'll be mad." And she was sworn to secrecy, and the whole practice of artificial insemination by donor was one where doctors swore the recipients and the donor, actually, to secrecy. And it was my birth certificate I looked at as a big hoax. The obstetrician was totally different than the fertility practitioner, and he was not notified that my father's sperm was not the sperm used, so he could legitimately put my dad's name on my birth certificate. And that was the practice then.
Right. So your mother ultimately reveals this to a number of different people, including, I believe, your wife.
Yeah, my wife told me.
Describe to our listeners what that scene was like. I mean, where you learned this for the first time, not actually from your mother, but from your wife.
Well, my wife and I were having dinner. We were actually in the midst of a marital crisis and undergoing some degree of therapy at the same time, some counseling. And I was a CEO of a company and ready to do a merger and acquisition activity. My phone rang at dinner, and I figured this is the deal about ready to close, and this phone call's going to take a little while. And it was my therapist on the line and not the M&A banker. And the therapist said, "Gosh, your wife called and left me a message that she had something to relate to me that would help in your therapy, and I haven't talked to her. Why don't you?" So I went back to my dinner table and relayed that to my wife, and almost growled. Didn't intend to growl, but I growled, "What the heck are you calling my therapist? What's going on?" So we got up from the table and sat down in the living room, and she unveiled the story of my mother telling stories at the rehab center. That my after 5 years of attempting to have a child after they married and they were not successful. She read an article or an ad in a paper about a fertility practitioner affiliated with Harvard. They went to see him. After a variety of testing, they concluded that my dad was sterile, and they had a couple of choices. Remain childless, one, adopt a child, two, or use this newfangled procedure with an anonymous sperm donor. And it was likely that the donor would be affiliated with Harvard Medical School in some way. Mm. That's about all I knew. She remembered the name of the doctor. She misremembered the name of the doctor because she ended up giving me the wrong name. And she gave me an address of his clinic, but that wasn't quite right either. So I had clues that were going nowhere. Mm.
One of the things that I found curious was that, I mean, I understand the part about your mother having experienced this stroke, which, of course, in a sense, broke down some of what would have been some of her restraint. We hear about that a lot, of course, with people who have experienced strokes, that suddenly they are kind of spilling the beans on all kinds of different things or speaking in unguarded fashion in ways that they never would have before.
The lock that guarded her secret no longer worked.
Right. What still strikes me as a little bit strange is why, of all things, it would be this that she would talk about. Do you think it is because it was this long-held secret and there was something that, I mean, that it gave her a sense of relief to release this secret that she had held so closely for decades? Do you think that's why she spoke about this?
Perhaps so. I mean, she was holding out for 50 years, 50. This was on the edge of my turning 50.
And when you speak to her, I think it's really interesting that at first she denies this. Once you've heard this from your wife and you are able to speak to your mother for the very first time, she at first is not able to admit that all of this is true. Tell us more about that situation and what it felt like when your mother finally relented and admitted that indeed it was true. I wonder in those first moments when she's denying it if you felt that there was any possibility that maybe this was some sort of fantasy she had created out of a mental fog, or were you quite certain that this had to be true and just waited for her confirmation?
You know, I had my own suspicions, but I didn't know why. I just knew I had suspicions. So I wasn't surprised in that regard, but I was hugely surprised nonetheless. I took her home from rehab. We arranged a dinner. She got dressed for the first time since coming back from the hospital and the rehab center. We finished dinner, did some small talk, and just said, "Mom, we have to talk. This is a story you've been telling." She said, "No, that's not true." And we put it out there again. "Well, I must have been delusional." And she continued to deny the story, and then my wife said to her, "You know, you got to put it out there." I told her that I had always been a little concerned about my inheritance of my father's problem, and I made up a story when I was a kid about my father's unipolar depression and how that was... The doctor told me it was the result of some medical procedures that he had as a child, and it upset his brain chemistry. And that was a way to protect me. And I tried it on my mother when I was a teenager, and that seemed to fly with her, too. So that was our story. But I told her that I had made that story all up. It was just a way to protect myself. And when I divulged that, she just broke down and confided that, okay, you were conceived with the help of an anonymous donor, your dad was sterile, and et cetera. Mm. And then she broke down and cried in her room for about 15 minutes before she returned.
Wow. As I said earlier, in the wake of this, and you've spelled out this wild tangle of varying emotions that this evoked from you, but you also felt this enormous sense of peace and relief because you suddenly knew that the man you knew as your father, he was not your biological father, and you did not sort of carry biologically whatever legacy there was that had led him to the tragic path of suicide. In the wake of learning this and knowing that it was true, then what did you decide you need to do?
Well, I wanted to find the source of my seed. What was my genealogy? What was my genealogical medical history? Did I have any siblings? I was just compelled to answer those questions. But I was really messed up from an emotional standpoint. I was, you know, not Italian, okay, not flawed any more than anyone else, but had all of these conflicting emotions. I learned a word when I was researching this thing. The word was misattributed. I was misattributed. I never knew the word misattributed before. I knew other miswords, you know, the misnomer, misconceived, misunderstood. Never misattributed. Misattributed is that your DNA and your birth certificate just don't jive. There's something askew, either with one or both of your parents. And the experts, in quotes, believe that some 2-4% of us are misattributed. Some experts think it's a little less, some think it's a lot more, but they'll basically agree to the 2-4% range. And how can that be? Well, the largest is the folks that learn that they were adopted late in life with closed adoption. You could be misattributed from a extramarital affair or a one-night stand or an unreported sexual assault. You could have been switched at birth, or like me, semi-adopted. In the old days, that's what they called artificial insemination with an anonymous donor. I was so conflicted and so emotional about this whole thing that I, with the support of my wife and the encouragement of some of my friends, I went to seek some therapy. Now, in the boardroom and in the war room, I had experienced that anyone who sought therapy was perhaps weak or flawed and unfit for command. So I was a CEO, and I needed this therapy, and I was very quiet about getting it. And I found a therapist that specialized in trauma, and he was funny. He said, congratulations, son, you hit a trifecta, because new trauma rekindles old trauma that was thought long past. And I had traumas from my childhood and the sickness of my dad, and certainly from the PTSD of war. And coming back from Vietnam, I was just one of those folks that just never talked about it. Society didn't want to hear about it.
So you had a lot to unpack, a lot to sort of sort out. And, of course, ultimately you went on a long journey to also discover exactly where and from whom you had come. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Peter Bonney, and we're talking about his book, Uprooted, Family Trauma, Unknown Origins, and the Secretive History of Artificial Insemination. We have not spent enough time talking about your father, and in particular, we have not talked about who he was, and especially all of the positive traits that for a long time made him quite a heroic figure to you in your eyes. And I really appreciate the affection and sensitivity with which you write about your father. Again, we're talking about the man you always knew as your father growing up. Tell our listeners more about who he was, and some of your most powerful memories of him as a father, apart from the difficulties, which we'll talk about next.
Well, my dad, I thought, was a wonderful guy. He was really the hero of his family. He was ambitious, adventurous, generous. He was kind. I mean, he did not intentionally get sick, but he suffered from bouts of depression. And as a younger man, he could just shake them off until he just couldn't. Old-school Italian family kept his condition hushed, believing that his mental illness reflected upon them. And they sought scapegoats for his illness, too, my mother and me. So after 4 years of repeated hospitalization, my dad just took his own life. I was just 16. I found that suicide just creates a wound that never heals, by the way. And I felt all that guilt and shame, and I felt abandoned and flawed. And I feared that his illness would actually pass on to me. And that knowledge that I carried a different gene pool by itself just lifted a huge cloud. And like I said, it took some therapy for me to internalize that being flawed is a human condition. I'm no more flawed than anybody else.
Hmm. One of the things that was so tough, of course, was when your family, it was really at your urging, relocates to Boston, where I believe your dad's family was, and out of the hope that maybe being close to his relatives, your dad would begin to do better and begin to recover. In fact, it was a very difficult situation when you relocated to Boston, and his family, while I'm sure still loving him, in a sense, really kind of stayed emotionally at arm's length. I mean, they were troubled by his troubles, and it sounds like they didn't really know what to do about that. Can you just describe that situation to us a little more?
Well, you know, mental illness reflected upon them, they thought, not really understood as well, you know, old school prejudices on it. A lot of whispers in the back room when we were at a dinner table about his illness as well. They just didn't understand it and didn't want to be associated with it. I felt as though they were abandoning him and abandoning me.
Right. At one point you write, in the collective eyes of my dad's family, I was the son of an embarrassment. And I mean, it's probably important to say that that's how it felt from your perspective. If they were to be asked, you know, they might characterize it differently, but certainly that's the way you felt like they were looking to you. And in the wake of this tragedy of his suicide, when again, you were just 16 years old, describe what you did in terms of trying to remake yourself and the kind of person that you desperately wanted to be.
Well, at his nearest funeral, I probably had a Scarlett O'Hara moment. You know, you look up at the sky, and as God is my witness, I'm going to get past this, and won't let this hold me down, and I'll just never be hungry again. Not that I was hungry, but I was bound and determined to make something of my life and just be successful and have some means. We had absolutely no money. Impoverished, I think, is a word I would use. So I was just committed to take all of my energy and be a successful person, to get past this.
And
so I did a lot of denial. I didn't really grieve like I should have grieved for the loss of my dad.
Well, ultimately, of course, you do achieve tremendous professional success, although I think, you know, one thing you're very honest about in your book is that your drive to be successful and that I'll never be hungry again, that drive caused certain problems, particularly with your marriage. And I appreciate the frankness with which you share about that. So we step back to that moment when you are 49 years old and you learn for the first time that the man that you thought of as your father was not your biological father, and that, in fact, you had been born via artificial insemination. I'm curious, at the time that you learned that, did you even know that such a thing was possible? I mean, I was shocked. I know very little about this before reading your book, and I never would have dreamt that there was such a thing as artificial insemination back in 1944, the year that your parents first went to this fertility specialist. I'm a little surprised there were fertility specialists in 1944, let alone something like artificial insemination. Were you similarly surprised, or did you know a little more than I do, and were you, or was that kind of a shocking revelation, not only that this was your story, but that such a thing was even possible so long ago?
Yeah, I did a lot of research on it. I knew about the 1995 version of it, and maybe read a few, couple of articles, and I knew of sperm banks and that sort of thing, but had no sense at all as to what was going on or the history of it. So I had used some of my mother's clues that were not good clues at all, and I just ran into stone walls. There were no records kept. My mother misremembered the name and location of the fertility specialist. The internet, by the way, was in its infancy. Google had another 3 years to even be founded, and then DNA over the internet itself was 12 years away from its first introduction by 23andMe. So all of those stone walls fueled what was my only recourse, which was therapeutic for me, actually, Greg, and that is a deep dive of research into the scientific, the sociological, and the legal history and the evolution of assisted reproductive technology and all of its secrets of practices. And I looked at it from early biblical references right through to today that enabled my conception in the first place. And part of the thing that drove me was genealogical bewilderment. In the mid-60s, a pair of psychologists were studying some late discovery adoptees and some issues that they were facing regarding their sense of belonging. And the premise is that anyone who is misattributed by whatever the reason will suffer from these confusing and conflicting emotions and be raging with this genealogical bewilderment to find the source of their gene pool, to find their genealogical health history, and ask the same question, do they have any siblings?
Hmm.
So the more I learned about the evolution of assisted reproductive technology, actually, Greg, the more I was energized to write what is somewhat of an expose from a very unique lens, my lens of being a donor-conceived person, on what has become a multi-billion-dollar industry. And it has several sub-segments that are all free from federal regulation, by the way. And the growth in those sub-segments, like sperm and egg and embryo, would attract the likes of J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs.
Well, and that's one of the things we'll explore is this lack of regulation in this industry. You write at one point in your book, the breeding of puppies enjoys greater oversight than this industry of reproductive assisted reproductive technology. Give us some sense of just how long a timeline we are talking about. I mean, at what point in human history were there the first serious explorations of some kind of assistance of this nature into the reproductive process? I mean, where does this begin?
Well, you know, you've got the top 10 secrets of assisted reproductive technology here, Greg. The first one is that artificial insemination was actually perfected by an exiled mad scientist that history has nicknamed Red Frankenstein. And that was in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But artificial insemination by a husband was first alleged in 1462 by a medieval king. And it was first documented in the 18th century by a physician of English royalty. But the very first artificial insemination by a donor took place in 1884 in the Jefferson Hospital in Philadelphia. And it was basically a criminal act inside of a medical school. And my book will outline all of that. Church and state just drove assisted reproductive technology and donor insemination underground in a shroud of secrecy throughout the 20th century. And the practices carried somewhat of a eugenics tone. By the mid-50s, back to the farm, frozen bull semen actually enabled today's Wild West of gamete distribution. And then you have 21st century science that has obsoleted 20th century practices in assisted reproductive technology. In the last 40 years, you have fertility rates in the Western world that are down. How much do you think?
Quite a lot, I understand, from your book. I don't remember the specific number.
Yeah, fertility rates down 50%, a combination of environmental factors and people just waiting longer to raise a family, and the biological clock doesn't work for them. But the population of donor-conceived people in the last decade is up 50%. So fertility rates down 50, the population of donor-conceived people up 50. Now, the 10th secret of assisted reproductive technology is a secret that hasn't been unveiled yet, and that is, given the ethical dilemma, there's another Red Frankenstein out there who is yet to be nicknamed.
One of the things you say is that because this is happening at such staggering numbers, I mean, so many people engaging in artificial insemination, that and because it lacks so many controls and oversights, that we have the specter of one anonymous sperm donor perhaps being responsible for 100 or more siblings, 100 or more siblings who very likely will not know anything about each other's existence. I mean, are we really talking about numbers like that?
Yes, no question. We have an assisted reproductive technology industry today that just is free from regulatory oversight, and that enables that conception of dozens, even 100, unknowing siblings from the same gamete donor. And there's no requirement, by the way, for testing. There's no requirement for registry. And there's no laws to combat what we might term as fertility fraud. That's when I learned this, I had a friend who was breeding Rottweilers, and he gave me his view that you mentioned, that is, the breeding of puppies is better supervised. The fix on this thing is a regulatory oversight in the form of a donor-conceived Bill of Rights, and I'm hopeful that I can use my book to shine the light on this thing to enable this donor-conceived Bill of Rights.
One of the things you say is that the United States lags behind other countries when it comes to controlling and regulating assisted reproductive technology industry. So, in other words, in other countries where perhaps this has been in place longer or talked about more openly longer, there are regulations and controls that that are significantly different from what exists here in the United States?
It's a patchwork quilt, Greg, depending upon the country. Here we have dedicated medical practitioners amidst a small subsegment of, let's call them rogues with no laws. The expanding science, that is frozen sperm, frozen egg, the embryo, the surrogacy, the uterine implants, all have created a billion-dollar subsegments in a hugely profitable industry. The social and legal acceptance of artificial insemination by donor has certainly enhanced over the beginning of the 21st century. But the distribution of gametes, that sperm, egg, embryo, has little regulatory oversight. It's a Wild West that's actually gone over the Internet like a flea market. We have industries that are not doing well with self-regulation. That's why we have the SEC and the FDA and the FTC and the FCC, and there's a Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, the National Organ Transplant Act. All giving some regulation to varying industries, but in the fertility arena, we have a self-regulated industry with flawed, obsolete practices that enable the conception of a dozen or even 100 unknowing siblings from the same donor.
Why do we have this situation? I mean, that is, how do you explain that lack of regulation? Because as you just pointed out, we regulate all kinds of things. Why not this? I mean, is there a particular reason why regulation is so strangely absent? I mean, is it because the industry itself has lobbied hard and aggressively to fend off any attempts, or have there not been serious attempts to create regulation?
Well, my own view is that your eighth grade science teacher was right, that inertia is a very powerful force. There's nothing stronger than the status quo. The free market, with some assistance of lobbying, has kept us, in quotes, self-regulated. There's an organization today that's the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. It's American in name only because they have members in over 100 different countries. And it's a trade association that provides networking and educational opportunities and public policy initiatives. That's a fancy way to say lobbying to maintain the status quo.
One of the things your book points out is who tends to engage in this, that is, who seeks out artificial insemination. And you kind of spell out at least the rough numbers in terms of the people and the kind of couples that seek out this particular assistance. Spell that out for our listeners, please.
Well, it's changed over time, but science will tell you that 15% of us have fertility issues. That's 15%. 40% are because of an issue with the woman, 40% an issue with the man. And in 20% of the cases, they each have issues. And it used to be that the couples, 15% of couples is a pretty large market, and that was the market for donor conception. You have the industry today that's evolved. It's not only sperm donors, but it's egg donors. We've been able to harvest eggs. We've been able to preserve embryos and freeze them. We've been able to do uterine transplants. We've been able to do births by surrogacy. So it's expanded the definition of artificial insemination and expanded the definition of the target recipient. And sociology has changed. The definition of a couple now is not necessarily a married couple, nor is it a heterosexual couple. And there's a sociology that has enabled single people also to have children. So the marketplace is much bigger today than it used to be.
Speaking of marketplace, one of the things that we at least used to hear about is how incredibly expensive it was to pursue this. I mean, for instance, a given couple with fertility issues might easily spend tens of thousands of dollars trying to become pregnant via one of these, you know, kind of through this kind of technology. Was it terribly expensive when your mother pursued this back in the 1940s? Is it still expensive today, or is this expanding market sort of changing some of the dynamics of how much this tends to cost?
Everything is relative. It was expensive for my parents. There was no insurance for this. Today, it is continually expensive. However, insurance companies, to a greater or lesser degree, have incorporated some degree of fertility in their benefits. Now, not all insurance companies will do this, but some will. And maybe it's a modest recovery, but it's a recovery nonetheless. But overall, it's a socioeconomic issue for people. Mm.
One thing you mention in your book in passing is the term illegitimate. and of somebody being an illegitimate child. And you tell us that this is one area of legislation in which something has been spelled out, and that you, for instance, if I understand this correctly, are a legitimate child, even though biologically your mother and father were not the mother and father who raised you. Can you untangle that for us, this term illegitimate?
Sure. Well, you know, in legal terms, setting a legal precedent is a huge thing. And in 1921, I believe it was, the Canadian courts viewed artificial insemination by a donor as a adulterous act, and the resulting child was considered illegitimate. The European courts took that in the later 20s, and they reinforced that. And by country and state by state, that continued to be the case. By the time of my conception in 1945, there was a Time magazine article that came out, and they were reviewing the legal status of a child as a result of a court case that went on in the Superior Courts in Cook County, Illinois. And the title of this article was Artificial Bastards with a Question Mark. What was the status of a child who was conceived from artificial insemination by an anonymous donor? And again, the courts concluded that the act was an adulterous act and the child was illegitimate. So for me, with the hoax, and the practice was the hoax, that is, that the insemination took place, didn't tell the obstetrician, and the obstetrician simply put the name of the husband on the birth certificate. So in that regard, hey, I'm perfectly legitimate. My birth certificate says that. Now, law has changed a little, too, in the 50 years since the legal precedent was set. I think it was in 1973, the Universal Parentage Act took away the word legitimate from a couple and did not require a couple to be married to have, in quotes, a legitimate child. In 2002, and again in 2015, the UPA was adjusted to reflect donor insemination and then reflect same-sex marriage.
Let's finish our conversation by talking about this long journey you took to try to discover your own biological roots, to try and learn the identity of your biological father, and whether or not you had any siblings. So tell us just a little bit about that long search and what you have been able to eventually uncover.
Well, with 21st century technology, we had a new company in 2007 came out. That was 23andMe, and the DNA over the internet for then $999, and I was among their early customers that signed up to seek my genealogy, seek my medical history, and find if I had any siblings. Now, 23andMe, as a new company, gave me the what. I wasn't Northern Italian. I was English, French, and Scandinavian on my paternal side. And it gave me some reflection of my gene pool's medical aberrations or the lack thereof. And I reviewed that with my doctor at the time, who told me, congratulations, it looks like I don't see any red flags here, but continue to practice good healthcare maintenance. But I didn't find any paternal relatives on 23andMe. But it was a new company, and the database was growing, so I gave it several years and kept on checking it out, looking for a paternal relative. I found a lot of maternal relatives, but no paternal relative. In 2012, actually, Ancestry.com, that was organized around doing family trees and records, came out with a DNA test. And by 2017, they had actually grown their database of customers to be as large or much larger than 23andMe. So I went off and I spit in the 23andMe, or rather in the Ancestry.com vial, and found a paternal relative. It said close relative, first cousin with a question mark. And there was no question to me that that was a paternal relative, and that was the first one I had seen. So I went off and contacted that person through the email system that Ancestry.com had, and that person was terrific and was a champion for me to find the source of my seed in that family tree. So we were successful in that. So I found the source of my seed and found my medical history and defined a sibling.
And I think you have found more than one sibling.
There are six of us at last count. Now, my questions have gone from do I have any siblings to how many siblings do I have really? The last one I found was actually in, there were a few of them, in February. And we call February new sibling season. It's the 23andMe and Ancestry.com and the other sites have holiday sales on Black Friday. And that adds about 2 million people to the database, and it takes 8 weeks to process. So in February, there's another couple of million people in the database, many of whom will be surprised.
Wow. And you, I think, have met at least one or two of the siblings.
I've met two sisters in this whole process, and this is the bonus. This is a home run for me. I grew up as an only child, and I'm an only child who's developed new relationships with some siblings that are really nice people, and they resemble me, and we share DNA.
A last quick question. If you could wave a magic wand and bring some regulation or control into the assisted reproductive technology industry, what would be the first thing you would do? What is most needed?
Well, it's a donor-conceived bill of rights that are really needed. I appreciate that donors and recipients all have rights, but there's no law in a book that gives any right to the donor-conceived person. I would abolish donor anonymity and deal with known donors only, since we have DNA science that has abolished it anyway, de facto. That seems like it's a slam dunk. I'd mandate donor genetic testing and then the disclosure of donor health history. I'd limit donor offspring. Today there's guidelines, but they're bad guidelines, not a good law, and they still enable the birth of over 100 siblings per donor. I'd establish a sibling registry that lets these varying siblings know who each other might be. Would you want to date a sibling? Would you want your children to date the child of your sibling? I would require donor and recipient counseling about the needs of a donor-conceived child. And I'd enact some legal recourse for blatant fertility fraud. Today, there's you can admonish a person and say, gee, that was very unethical, but there's no law against it. There's no recourse.
The book, again, is Uprooted, Family Trauma, Unknown Origins, and the Secretive History of Artificial Insemination, published by Greenleaf, the author Peter Bonney. Peter Bonney, thank you so much for giving the world this fascinating book, and very best wishes to you.
Thank you, sir.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the first monthly visit of 2022 of our good friend Nan Calvert from Root Pike Wynn. Her guest with her tomorrow will be Allison Werner, who is executive director of the nonprofit River Alliance of Wisconsin, based in Madison. Its primary purpose is to help safeguard the freshwater supply of the state of Wisconsin for all of its citizens. And we'll find out about their good work. And on Friday, I reconnect with Dr. Anthony Barnhart, who is Associate Professor of Psychological Sciences at Carthage and a magician on the side. And during J-term right now, Professor Barnhart is teaching a fascinating course called The Cognitive Science of Magic and bringing in a lot of his